I thought I would start with this morning with an understatement. People sometimes misunderstand some basic truths about God. That is very much the case. Even people that should know better sometimes have misunderstandings about some things with regard to what is the nature of God, or exactly who is He, or how does He relate to people, and all of that. But one of the things that we want to think about today is that they tend to focus on one attribute over another, and they will pick out a particular aspect or understanding or attribute or perfection of God and kind of camp on that and make that the major thing that they build all of their understanding on. And that's not going to be healthy, and we need to think something about that. But we also realize that getting a proper view of God is not always easy, because we have limitations, as much as we don't like to have to admit that, but we do. There's so many different areas where there can be misunderstanding, and there's so much misinformation out there. And our tendency is to want to imagine God as how we want Him to be. And that can be a problem. The only solution is to try to get a handle on whatever revealed truth there is about God in the universe as a whole, from whatever natural revelation there is, but also from the revealed truth that He has given us, from the supernatural revelation that we have in our hands, and that's what we want to be thinking about. So today we want to consider two truths in particular that the text references about God, and try to keep that in some perspective. And there are a couple of aspects that relate to God that are often viewed as in conflict, or people tend to lean in one direction or another and get imbalanced. And so we want to keep that in mind as well. And we need to realize, again, that we have limitations. We're finite beings, and we're trying to understand an infinite God. So that's a factor. And just realizing God is bigger, greater than we can comprehend, because He is something other than what we are. We refer to that as His transcendence. He transcends. He is above and beyond us. He's, one way I've referenced before, is He's made out of different stuff. He's not the same as we are. Therefore, that's going to be a bit of a stretch for our limited nature to comprehend. He is unlimited by nature. And yet He is knowable. I mean, Scripture communicates that He's knowable on a personal level. And we can see things in nature about Him as well as in His Word. And so He is not only transcendent, but He's immanent. He's right here with us. And if you may recall Romans chapter 1, verse 20, it says, "Since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen." What? Clearly seen? Are we seeing those things? Well, if we have a context and an awareness and an aptitude, we ought to be able to see those things, because we have the image of God in us, so that we have the wherewithal to be able to relate and understand. But we may deny that. Of course, that's what part of the rest of this chapter in Romans 1 deals with. And it says, "Being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." So that kind of puts us in our place. There is the ability to have an understanding of who He is. So our text today is going to help us think about at least two attributes that are sometimes seen in conflict. How do we reconcile God's grace and His justice? God's love and His holiness, His righteousness, different aspects of the same basic area. How do we put those together? Well, this text is going to be dealing with both of those, not the main thing all the way through, but it's at least touching on it because they're related. And this passage, the whole situation, every bit of life relates to these things. We have to deal with elements of God's justice in the daily routine of life all the time. We have to deal with elements of God's grace in the daily routine of life all the time. So if these are two different attributes of God, and they seem to have a different emphasis, how do we fit them together? That's the challenge that we need to think about. And we may want to be thinking about, well, how can God deal differently with different people at different times, which Scripture clearly communicates is what He does? Is that suggesting, well, God's fickle, He's capricious, or is He purposeful? And I would certainly suggest that He is purposeful and He has the bigger picture in view, even if we don't. So this chapter began, chapter 30, verse 1, with a woe to the rebellious children, says the Lord. And this is a woe that kind of continues, and we'll see some more of those in the text. We've seen some before. It's kind of a warning passage. But the first section of this chapter was dealing with human activity, the things that the people were doing. And now it's going to be a little bit more focused on divine activity, things that God is doing. And so this passage is going to be distinguishing God's faithfulness ultimately in the larger, bigger picture, verses 18 through 26, and then His faithfulness imminently coming up very soon, verses 27 to 33. There's an important element to remember here for us, and that is that human unfaithfulness does not destroy divine faithfulness. Let me say that again. Human unfaithfulness does not destroy divine faithfulness. You may remember 2 Timothy 3:13. It says, if we are faithless, He remains faithful. He cannot deny Himself because He is who He is. He is consistent and He does what He says. And God has a plan. He has promises in place. He is going to be consistent with that. He made promises with His people through Abraham. In the Old Testament that has continuing implications on to the present and into the future. And He's going to bring those to pass. And His covenant relationship with those people drives the things that He is doing, His actions, His relationship to them. And so all that needs to be kept in mind. And so as we look at this text, we're just looking at this last section of Isaiah chapter 30 in two parts. And so the first part we're going to be thinking about is the Lord provides distant restoration in spite of unfaithfulness. There's hope. There's somewhere that things are moving that have a hopeful emphasis that even though things don't look so good right now at the time that Isaiah is communicating these things, in the distant future, there is restoration. And then we'll see that there's some other things relative to a closer period of time as well. So starting with verse 18, therefore the Lord will wait that He may be gracious to you, and therefore He will be exalted that He may have mercy on you. So there's that grace and the mercy. For the Lord is a God of justice. Well, there's that other word that we had noted. Blessed are all those who wait for Him. So here we have the Lord waiting, and then it talks about those who wait for Him. All in verse 18. And then verse 19. For the Lord shall dwell in Zion, for the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. He will be very gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When He hears it, He will answer you. So there's a great emphasis on grace here, recognizing also that he is a God of justice. So he is going to be sure that things are functioning within certain parameters. So the Lord's justice operates through his grace. And we see the Lord acts consistently with his just nature. He is not inconsistent. He doesn't act one way in his justice at one time and another time in his grace that are inconsistent. They are always consistent. He is a God of justice, which means he will do what is right at the right time, all the time, every time. And it has to do with his righteousness, his holiness. Isaiah 5:16 says, "But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness." So the execution of his judgment, which is part of his justice, is consistent with the rest of his nature and his holiness, his righteousness. And then Isaiah 28:17 says, "Also I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plummet. The hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters will overflow the hiding place." Here again, justice is part of his nature and part of his action, his function. Then Isaiah 61:8 says, "For I, the Lord, love justice. I hate robbery for burnt offering. I will direct their work in truth. I will make them an everlasting covenant." Again, emphasizing that he is in relationship with them, and that is going to be a part of what works in conjunction with his justice, because he is in relationship with them, which also is going to have something to do with his exhibition of grace. So since he promised to bless his people, he will also, after punishing them or disciplining them for their lack of trust, he will extend grace and compassion to them. And he will do so at the right time, where it talks about he will wait. He will wait for the right time, and he will act according to his plan because he has things laid out. So those who long for him, or where it says at the end of verse 18 there, wait for him, anticipate, have a hope for him, will experience blessing when their waiting for his perfect timing is over. Again, looking at a couple of passages from Isaiah chapter 26, verse 8. "Yes, in the way of your judgments, O Lord, we have waited for you. The desire of our soul is for your name and for the remembrance of you." This idea of waiting, seeking, being interested in the desire of our soul, for instance, is part of the picture. And then chapter 33, verse 2 says, "O Lord, be gracious to us. We have waited for you. Be their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble." So this is acknowledging that while the Lord on the one hand is a just God and he will enact his punishment, his discipline as needed, he will do so consistent with his grace as well, and he will do it in grace. And it's not dissimilar to what one does as a parent with a child. When we have a child who disobeys, we have a bigger picture in view where we will discipline them, and at the time, the child will think, "Well, what gives? Don't you love me? Why would you do that to me?" And we're doing it because we love them, because we know you need this discipline in order to be where you ought to be. And so we need that. And the Lord does that with us as well. The Lord acts consistent with his gracious nature. The Lord exercises grace and mercy on his people. And again, part of the grace is providing the discipline so that they can be where they need to be before the Lord, because he knows what's best for them. So in spite of the tears that come with the discipline, the Lord has a bigger picture in view, and he will provide the comfort and the caring that is needed. And the people that are in view here are specifically identified as those of Zion and Jerusalem. So Isaiah is fairly focused on who he's dealing with, and that has been generally the case all through his writing. And God will answer their prayers, and there will be joy that will come from this as they submit to him and seek him and wait on him, as the emphasis is there. And this joy will come in the future. But remember, we're talking about 100 years before the major discipline is going to be enacted. And that'll be coming in right around the 600 time frame. This is about the 700 BC time frame. So that's what they have to anticipate. And after their captivity, they had some positive responsiveness to the Lord, and they had some realization that we have sinned, we have messed up, and we need to get back to where we were, because we're in covenant relationship with him, and we need to act like we're in covenant relationship with him, which they hadn't been for many years. And so that's what was anticipated. But there's going to be an ultimate fulfillment of this exhibition of graciousness that's going to be taking place after the second coming, when the Lord comes back and puts down the enemies and establishes the millennial kingdom, when there will finally be the peace and the bringing to pass of those things that have been predicted and promised all along. And so there is that future, but there will be glimpses and elements of it that will be taking place previous to that, providing the hope that is needed for these people right now, who are roughly 100 years before the big judgment that's coming on them, and the Lord in his grace is warning them and is giving them a sense of encouragement and hope if they will only pay attention. So there is some hope for restoration if they'll just respond to him. And that's what Isaiah has been trying to bring to their attention. Then verses 20 to 22 says, "And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore." And some translations translate the teachers as teacher singular and have it capitalized as referring to the Lord. Just so that you see that if you have a different version, we'll have to think about that in a moment. But your eyes shall see your teachers. So there was a time when they weren't paying attention to their teacher or teachers, whichever way you want to read it, but the time would come when they would pay attention to what is being communicated. And then verse 21, "Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, 'This is the way, walk in it,' whenever you turn to the right hand or whenever you turn to the left. You will also defile the covering of your images of silver and the ornament of your molded images of gold. You will throw away any as an unclean thing, and you will say to them, 'Get away.'" So there's an element of responsiveness that is anticipated here. So the Lord's people will respond with repentant actions. And an observation that we want to make that has implications for us is, after suffering adversity, people may be more open to listen. Now, have you ever noted that? Sometimes we have to go through a hard time in order for the Lord to get our attention, and then we finally start going, "Oh, I see what you're trying to communicate to me now." So the implication here seems to be something to the effect that the Lord was not readily visible to the people during their time of judgment because they weren't really focused on him. They hadn't been paying attention. They weren't looking to him. They weren't looking for him. They were focused on their own things. So the Lord was somewhat in the background in their thinking. He was still there, but they weren't really seeing him. And so then they went through a time of adversity, and the picture is like what someone would suffer the privation of food and drink as in a prison sentence or something of that nature. And after their discipline, then the Lord would be again visible to them because they're paying attention. Because now they're saying, oh, the Lord is trying to get my attention here. Wow. And so then the reference to teachers is taken as singular by some of the translations and understood as referring to God. He is the main teacher, but he may be speaking through other teachers. It is literally plural in the text, but the ultimate teacher would be the Lord that's indicated, and that's why some have translated it singular. But whether the emphasis is on the human teachers, that is the prophets and priests and so on who are trying to communicate truth to them, ultimately God is the one who is communicating, and so therefore the singular fits as well. And they would see him, and their ears would hear, and his voice would be correcting the deviations in their path. And that's what they needed to be able to take into consideration. And then after returning to the Lord, people may remove baggage. Sometimes people get things in the wrong order. The correct order is to get right with God and then do some house cleaning and fix things up in your life. Sometimes people get it backwards and they think, well, if I just get my life fixed up, then God will accept me and then I can come to him. No, he says, yeah, that's wrong. You need to get right with me first and then worry about fixing things. Because there isn't enough that we can fix to make things right with God. We need to have the heart attitude. That's the thing. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. I mean, that's not saying get all your ducks in a row and make sure that your house is tidy. In the spiritual sense, that's not there. Get right with God first, get the relationship right, and then deal with the other things. Keep it in the right order. That's the emphasis that's communicated here. And so the people of Judah then are going to be demonstrating a change of attitude, a change of commitment, and they're going to deal with their idolatry. One of the biggest problems that the people of Israel and Judah were dealing with was idolatry. They were embracing the idol worship of the peoples around them, and it was constantly a problem. Now, different kings would come along in the southern kingdom, not in the northern kingdom, they never got it straight. But in the southern kingdom, some kings would come along, like Hezekiah and Josiah and Joash, and they would kind of bring things back and get rid of some of the garbage. And then it would come back again. You had like Manasseh, who just, you know, really brought stuff so that idolatry was so prevalent. And he was king for 55 years. Just think how far down the tubes you can go in 55 years. I mean, how far have we gone in just a few years in our own country? Where you see, good night, how did we go from where we were to where we are? I mean, you know, the slope went from like this to like this. And just really going down. So they had to deal with idolatry. The interesting thing, what is the one thing that the nation seemed to get a handle on after the captivity? Idolatry. It pretty much disappeared. They actually caught on. It's like, really? Why don't we catch on to things? Well, maybe we need 70 years in captivity. That might do it. That's what it took for them. And this is 100 years before that, warning them to get it together, telling them what's going to happen. But we also recognize that when one is rightly related to God and one really has things focused on him and are captivated by the presence and person of God, idolatry tends to fall away as even being appealing because we have a right understanding and a right relationship, and it puts things in place. And sometimes we need to refocus our thinking so that the things that are capturing our attention are pushed to the side, that we're focused on the relationship with God, and then we can deal with those other things. So get right with God and then deal with the other issues so that God doesn't have to bring adversity into our lives to get our attention so that we can get it in the right order. Then verses 23 to 24, and then we'll do the next couple of verses after. Then he will give the rain for your seed, with which you sow the ground, and bread of the increase of the earth. It will be fat and plentiful. Now, in our day, you know, you see the word fat, and you think, oh, bad, bad, bad. And here it's saying fat is a good thing. I mean, that's the fat of the land. So here, if you're, you know, if you've got this issue, this thinking in your head that fat's bad, just try to think of it in a slightly different sense, and then maybe you'll feel better. Just don't misunderstand what I'm saying there. In that day, your cattle will feed in large pastures. Likewise, the oxen and the young donkeys that work the ground will eat cured fodder, which has been winnowed with the shovel and fan. So this is looking at some hopeful things that are going to be coming to pass. Then verses 25 and 26, there will be on every high mountain and on every high hill rivers and streams of water. In the day of the great slaughter when the towers fall. So this is putting a time frame on it. When is the day of the great slaughter? It's talking about an exact day. It's talking about a time frame that's looking to the future when the kingdoms of this world will be put in their place. And where it talks about the towers fall, what image comes to your mind when you think of towers? Well, the Tower of Babel is one, and this was a kingdom that was as focused on itself. We want to make a name for ourselves. And so that's the picture that's there. So this is looking toward the tribulation period, when the great slaughter, this is at the end of the tribulation period when the Son of God comes and puts things in place. Moreover, the light of the moon will be as the light of the sun. In other words, it's going to be brighter. And the light of the sun will be sevenfold. Well, you kick that up a few notches, and you think it's warm in New Mexico in the summertime. What is that going to do? As the light of 7 days in the day that the Lord binds up the bruise of his people and heals the strokes of their wound. So there's a time coming when there's going to be some rather visible manifestation of God at work in things, and it will have some physical impact in the astronomical areas, but also in the physical areas as well, which is associated again with the return of Christ and the establishment of the millennium. So that's the time frame that's noted here. The Lord will provide all the basic elements of life. Verse 23 to 26. As we've just noted that. In the future, the Lord will bless the land with abundance. There will be a time of rain so that the harvest will be plentiful. There'll be a time of great blessing. That'll be coming in the future associated with the return of Christ, because that's when that great slaughter and the towers fall is going to be taking place. The agriculture of the region where the people lived at this time that Isaiah was talking to was totally dependent on rain. Everything was dependent on that. So it was very much a case of dependence upon the Lord. That's why they often went into idolatry, because some of the other gods were associated with like Baal, and so we're associated with fertility, and that had to do with the provision of the rain and all of that. And so they thought, well, we better cover all our bases. We better make sure that we appease all the gods. And so that's what they ended up doing. That's why they went with this idolatry thing. And so because that, their whole life was dependent in that way on it. Now, we know the land of Israel has the benefit of irrigation, which has been a great asset for them. But there would also be abundant pasture land for the cattle. They would eat the best food. And again, this is an encouraging word about what the future holds. And it's thinking about a time when people would be responsive to the Lord, when they would be obedient. And it's trying to encourage the people of Isaiah's day, look what can happen if you obey, if you respond to the Lord. And they didn't take that lesson very well to heart. At that time, the physical realm will be significantly altered. We've referenced several of the things there, the increase of light and in the healing. And I'm not going to go into any detail on that, but we'll move forward then to the next section. The Lord provides imminent restoration in spite of unfaithfulness. And so this is thinking about bringing back to the time, because it was focused on the end time when Christ returns, but this is now coming back to Isaiah's time of the people where he's dealing with more directly, where we read, beginning at verse 27, "Behold, the name of the Lord comes from afar, burning with his anger, and his burden is heavy, his lips are full of indignation, and his tongue like a devouring fire." So he's saying, if you people would just be responsive to the Lord, then you could see the glory that is coming in the future. But if you don't, guess what? The Lord is coming, and he's going to make his presence known in a way that you probably don't want to have to deal with him. His breath is like an overflowing stream which reaches up to the neck to sift the nations with the sieve of futility. And there shall be the bridle of the jaws of the people, causing them to err. The Lord will intervene in behalf of his people. Here we note the Lord has a personal investment and interest in his people. And so here he's reverting back to Isaiah's day and Judah's present situation. And it's indicating that the focus is predominantly on there's judgment coming and it's going to affect all people. But guess what? You need to be paying attention as well. The Lord has an interest in you. He's concerned about you. But part of that concern is you need to obey. You need to be obedient. You need to listen or you're going to find yourself in the same state of judgment. The Lord would come from heaven to judge the nations. Well, we know that the Lord is going to come at the end of the tribulation period. That's a very direct thing, but there's also imagery here that is used in other places. It's kind of a strong anthropomorphic coming in references to human form and a theophanic or godlike in appearance where God has intervened in history. In Israel's history, we see throughout the Old Testament many different occasions, as we see referenced in Exodus, where God was on the mountain and his presence was very clearly seen, and all the different activities that he brought the people through. So God's anger is seen as burning like fire. His judgment would overwhelm the people like a flood. It would sift the nations in judgment. And there's accountability. And his people need to recognize that it's going to be a judgment that's coming, and they're going to be swept up in it in the process if they're not going to be responsive and obedient to him. You can avoid the discipline if you obey, is what the picture is. Verses 29 and 30 say, "You shall have a song as in the night when a holy festival is kept, and gladness of heart as when one goes with a flute to come into the mountain of the Lord, to the mighty one of Israel." And that's basically indicating as you respond to the Lord, then there's a more hopeful situation. Verse 30, "The Lord will cause his glorious voice to be heard and show the descent of his arm with the indignation of his anger and the flame of a devouring fire with shattering tempest and hailstones." Again, if you're responsive, it'll be a positive thing. If you're not, then look out. So the Lord's people will rejoice at the Lord's deliverance. The support of the Lord gives good reason for celebration. There will be a time when they will experience the Lord's blessing, but it will involve their proper responsiveness, and then they will have good reason to praise Him and celebrate and worship Him. The Lord's presence is not without significant visible manifestation. The Lord makes Himself known, and and He will do so in grace, but He'll also do so in justice and judgment and in righteousness. And both are at work, and their responsiveness will be the factor that determines which they're going to experience. And there's, again, an emphasis on a near and a far picture that is referenced as well. Then looking at verses 31 and 32. For through the voice of the Lord, Assyria will be beaten down as he strikes with the rod. Now here we all of a sudden are reminded, oh yeah, we're talking about the people that right now are on Judah's mind because they're basically knocking at the front door. And so they need to deal with Assyria. So Isaiah hasn't forgotten that. He's looking to the future, but then he brings it back to the present. In every place where the staff of punishment passes, which the Lord lays on him, it will be with tambourines and harps, and in battles of brandishing, he will fight with it. So he's going to be involved in putting the people who are against him in their place. That's the picture that's there. And then the last verse here. For Tophet was established of old. Yes, for the king it is prepared. He has made it deep and large. Its pyre is fire with much wood. The breath of the Lord, like a steam of brimstone, kindles it. Now we'll have to figure out what in the world is he talking about here. It reminds me of the nursery rhyme. Little Miss Muffet sat on a Tophet? Is that what it was? Maybe not. Just kidding. The enemy of God's people will tremble at God's judgment. The Lord will show his great concern for Judah at this time. And we kind of need to always add, in spite of where the people were at this time in their spiritual relationship with the Lord is still going to provide for them because he's exercising his grace while also anticipating the judgment that is coming, the discipline, the justice. And part of what he's going to do is he's going to put Assyria in its place because that has an impact on what his plan is for the people of Judah for the future. So the Lord will show his great concern. The voice of the Lord would put Assyria in her place, and he would use his staff or his scepter and his rod. And the basic idea is that there isn't anything that Assyria can do against the Lord and against the Lord's people if the Lord has determined something for them, and that's what the case is here. And we know that ultimately the defeat of his enemies will take place, as noted in Revelation 19. But in this case, it's talking about something that's going to be coming in the near future. And a reminder here is it's always best to be on the Lord's side in all of these things, and we want to make sure that we are finding ourselves there as well. The breath of the Lord will bear down on the enemy. Now, there's a reference here to Tophet. It refers to a funeral pyre or a place of burning, and it was a heathen usage that was referenced here. The Hebrew word that's used, it means a disgraceful burning place or a fireplace. And in this, the particular reference here is that it was prepared long ago for the king of Assyria. Well, it has a particular geographical and contextual area in mind. It's referring to the Valley of Hinnom. which is just south of the southern edge of Jerusalem. Here you have the Kidron Valley, which is between the main section that you usually see of Jerusalem, where Mount Moriah, the Temple Mount, is right here. Mount of Olives is over here. Central Valley on this side. The older city of Jerusalem is in this lower part here, the city of David. And then over here is the Hinnom Valley. So the Kidron Valley and the Hinnom Valley kind of connect in a sense here. But this was the garbage dump over here. But I hear now you can go there and you can get some fine restaurants there. So, but it's been pointed out that the garbage has been removed, so you don't have to eat the garbage. But that was the place that was associated with the idolatry of child sacrifice. And the burning place is associated with that as well. So it has a very negative connotation. And a place where judgment is in view because of the sin and the wickedness that had taken place there. So this is a prediction of the demise of Assyria, which is literally fulfilled in the future. There's going to be the major demise of the capital of Assyria in 612, Nineveh, and then Assyria is routed at Carchemish in northern Syria when the Babylonian Nebuchadnezzar II ended the Assyrian dominance in the land about 605 BC. And so also we remember that the people of Assyria that were fighting in the area of Jerusalem, and they had done a lot of damage in some of the other cities around, and the Lord specifically and directly and immediately put an end to those soldiers, as is noted in Isaiah 37, 36 to 37. And we've referenced that before, and we'll see it again when we get there. But that's where the Lord decimated the army without Israel or Judah having to do anything. And so, again, the Lord is indicating he is driving things here. He has a plan. He has a purpose. It wasn't the time for Jerusalem to be taken by Assyria at this time, even though it had impacted a lot of other places around. So we see again, the justice and grace of the Lord continued to work in tandem. And they worked in the experience of Judah, and they work in our experience as well. And we can avoid a lot of problems if we are simply obedient to the Lord, so that he doesn't have to bring us back in judgment or discipline and get our attention if we just simply obey in the first place and get things the way they ought to be by according to his word. And so that's the emphasis that's communicated here. And an additional lesson that we might want to take home from this is that we can be instruments of grace as well. As we are right with the Lord and want to live for him, and then we can share that hope, that good news. And there's definitely a need for hope. I mean, they were facing some difficult times. We face some difficult times. People have great needs. There are lots of frustrations. Things aren't going exactly the way we think they may need to be going. But we can be right with the Lord, and we can offer the hope and the sense of purpose and meaning that people need who are part of the lost world around us. And we can then be part of God's working in the world, where he's exercising his justice, his righteousness, his holiness, as well as his grace and mercy. And we can be part of that.